life is too short to drink cheap scotch.
Well, I'm very interested to see what you think of this week's albums. Well, two weeks ago's albums.
I just saw that Erin Riley asked that she really, really wished that she had like a live commentary of me tweeting about the Bogut Rod Hogg thing. I think I'd rather put my head through the fucking television. The problem is you can't put your head through televisions anymore.
No, they're very flat.
They just sort of bounce off because they're all kind of rubbery. Bring back televisions you can fucking neck yourself with.
Jesus.
So yeah, we have had a bit longer with these albums than we would have expected. Not to say that we actually listened to them anymore, because I know I haven't fucking touched them since last week. So.
Well, then,
no surprise.
The funny
there.
Thing was, I listened to them when I've been fighting this cold pretty much since, you know, we picked them, and I could not get into them, and I sort of. You know, I was hoping I'd feel better on the Sunday and I was going to give him a real whack, but I was just fucked on the Sunday. But basically just lay around and watch Star Wars with the kids. And this week I've been feeling a little bit better and I had a much more positive reaction to all three of the albums this week. And I'm just like, I don't know what effect the cold and flu medication's had on my perception of these albums, but where would you like to start?
Well, I mean... when you feel crook, you do kind of your sensations do kind of get stuffed up. You know, you don't want stuff you're not familiar with, and you know, this is stuff you might not be necessarily familiar with. There's sort of an overarching theme here, which is interesting to get into. Like the albums we reviewed the last time we sat down and talked, which were Unknown Mortal Orchestra and The Cavemen, were both expat. Kiwiaks. And that is interesting from a perspective of I didn't quite appreciate until I moved to New Zealand and got to understand the place how important, how central and significant the idea of the OE, the big OE, the big overseas experience is what the OE stands for. It's this rite of passage where Kiwis, you know, when they leave school, when they leave university, they are driven to migrate. They are driven to go somewhere else. Is it if it's Australia, if it's America, if it's London, you know, just like Australians do. But it's so embedded in their culture, there's a term for it, which I certainly wasn't the case with Australians. And it's also that, like Australia as well, New Zealand bands need to break it overseas in order to be properly seen as being the shit at home. You can be big at home, but when you break it overseas, like Lord, or like the fucking Split Ends or She Had or the fucking Datsuns.
Or the Concords.
When you're being appreciated by, say, you know, someone overseas, whether it's John Paul Jones producing the Datsuns or whether it's Taylor Swift hanging out with Lord or whatever, it's only then that they become stratospherically important. What we've got here this week, though, are two artists, if you like, that are still within New Zealand. They haven't made that jump. They're not over there. I understand October's album was recorded in Australia, but by and large, they haven't cracked the overseas market yet. They haven't become like Flight of the Conchords or the America's Cup Boat. You know, it's like little countries have an insecurity about them whereby they want to be recognised by the rest of the world, and then they'll realise that they're actually quite good at stuff. So I just thought I'd say that just to lead into the idea of that. Of some of these albums. We might as well start with October.
So this album was surprising. I on first listening.
Well, for starters, you said it was a band, and it's not. It's a femme pop artist. I think she styles herself more as a producer because she produced all the stuff on this. In fact, she reproduced all the stuff on this album because she got it back from the people who'd done the production. And she said, I hate it. I'm going to redo it at the short notice immediately. Before releasing
I don't know whether Ace McWicket is rubbing off on me, because not only did I enjoy this album, but
he'll rub off on a lot of things. You know, he's been arrested for something.
But I've got that Carly Rae song on my daycare playlist, and I was driving home this afternoon, and it popped up, and I was like, "I'm starting to like this song," and I was like, "Oh man, it's just like what's the Stockholm syndrome? Eventually, you turn to love your captors." But I didn't mind this album. It was quirky pop. It was not sort of straight down the line pop. It was...
It's kind of post-Gaga, pseudo-industrial beats. You know, there's a lot of those kind of heavy bang clang, slightly blown out kind of beats.
There was enough to keep me interested. I don't know whether I could listen to it 20 times, and it's definitely not making my short list for consideration for the end of the year, but I definitely enjoyed listening to it today.
I think I came up with a phrase for it. It's called, because it's a little bit more abrasive and harsh, and that's on purpose. I remember I read an interview with her on the spin-off, which is the New Zealand news and pop culture website, which she talked about the production of the album, which, you know, she took it all back and did it all herself, because she, it was interesting that she says, I see myself as a producer, not a singer. That's really what I'm what I'm good at, what I like to do.
It sounds almost like a Kiwi Bjork.
But she, I mean, the proof is in the pudding, and the pudding is...
It's very poppy. When you pull it apart,
pretty... It's within the realms of what pop is now. It's well, I mean, it's got the bang and clash and the sort of the homeopathic Skrillex-style industrial beats. But what if we call this... This is a style of music that we're seeing quite a bit of now. I propose we call it grit pop.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Because it's got a bit of grit and it's still... Okay. Or... Is it just recycled garbage? Because it did actually remind me a little bit of later era and more downbeat.
I've washed garbage. My brain of that later era garbage, to be honest. I like grit pop. I think grit pop's a good description because it's enough. It doesn't have that super sweet edge of pop that I, you know, it's got enough sandpapered off it that I can get into it. And by getting into it, I mean I enjoy listening to it in the moment. It can come on and I'm like, oh, I quite enjoy this. It's not something that grabs, that sort of roots down in your brain. Like, I always talk about what's the song at the end of the week that you think, oh, what do I want to add to a playlist? Like, I actually added one of the Catalyst songs to the boys' playlist because... Which song was that, actually? Because I just found myself...
Catalyst or the Space Invaders?
Sorry. Okay. Welcome. I added Welcome to the daycare playlist because I found I was walking around humming, like subconsciously humming the, you know, little bits of the melody to it. And none of this grabs my subconscious in that way. Like it's sort of straight into my brain and straight out. It's, yeah, that's about.
It's entirely disposal.
Yeah, well, maybe she's not expecting it to be more than that. So I don't know.
Well, no, I feel like she's poured a lot of herself into it. And when I read the piece, it was like she's talking about how it's all about the alienation you feel in your 20s and all these sort of social experiences and all this sort of stuff. And I'm like, I listened to the album, like I got none of that.
Well,
I don't know where that was supposed to be, but that wasn't.
We're a fair way away from our 20s though.
But I was looking for it. I was listening to the lyrics and I was like, no, you've not done a good job of communicating that at all. So
the Emmett...
I might not be in my 20s, but I do understand words. Yes. I can still understand the English language.
Mostly. Ebon Sparrow is the sort of album that I would have enjoyed 10 years ago. This real melancholy... It actually reminded me a little bit. I put... Sea Change by Beck on for the kids this week. And it's that same real deliberately slow. That's right.
I mean, they're a Wellington band. They're from a big city. They're actually old.
But this started to drag about halfway through for me.
Only halfway.
What about track three for you?
Well, track three was Mount Vic, and I thought it was interesting that it reminded me that country music is much more of its time and place than pop and rock, and they're very much singing about times and places, and being Wellington band, was singing about Victoria and stuff like that. But whereas getting back to that idea of place, that idea of New Zealand bands wanting to go overseas to be relevant, October's album could have been from anyone, anywhere in the world. It could have been released in
absolutely.
London. It could have been recorded in fucking San Diego. Whereas this at least feels like it has rooted somewhere. Certainly rooted. I did like the fact that I dug into their back catalogue a little bit, but and found that the Ebb of part of it is the lead singer, whose name is Ebony Lamb, which would make her the black sheep of the family. This album was fucking mournful, and I don't want to hear it ever again. But I appreciate that you tried to find New Zealand.
I did actually try. Which brings us to the Mint Chicks, which I really enjoy.
Mint Chicks are complicated.
Because
they were deliberately.
Yeah, this is an album that sort of goes in a few different directions. How would you?
Should I recap the Mint Chicks story?
Recap and then try and explain to me why the first half of the album seems to be like a different sort of second half. Yeah.
So. We did Unknown Mortal Orchestra last week, which is the project of Ruben Nielsen, who's one half of the creative group of the Mint Chicks, which is basically two brothers, who Oasis style write all the songs and fight a lot. They formed the Mint Chicks in the early aughts and had a meteoric rise and a roller coaster style fall subsequently, but they were the hottest shit in all of New Zealand music, not just indie music, from sort of 05, 06 through to 09 was when they were granted, they were, this album was voted or chosen as the best album of the 90s of New Zealand, which I think we've both said is arguable, and I think that given that the magazine in question has gone bust since, it probably tells its own story. But these two, Cody and Ruben, have always had a fractious creative relationship. I mean, they've always been brothers, you don't have a choice about that, but they've always had a fractious creative relationship, and that's reflected in this album. Their first album was much more and on the low, I'd missed the fact that Cody Nielsen has actually joined Unknown Mortal Orchestra very quietly. So technically, the
Mint Chicks. Yeah, right.
Because it just Cody's touring with, but they're doing, but they're, it's more Ruben's creative project, whereas the Mint Chicks was much more mixed because Cody was the lead singer of the Mint Chicks, and he was out up the front, and they were known for, you know, chaotic and destructive fucking live shows and, you know, trashing sets and climbing fucking things, and they broke up at a live show where, you know, they trashed the set and Cody screamed at his brother, "Start your own fucking band," and stormed off, and, you know, catastrophic disaster and all that sort of stuff. But they always felt like kind of the Ritalin generations, the New Zealand, sort of a New Zealand cousin of Regurgitator in the Ritalin generation, because they had that kind of restless, irritable ADHD kind of energy, and it was particularly relevant, particularly the case in the predecessor to this, which was called Fuck the Golden Youth, which came out a year before. This is much, a little bit more discordant and a bit more art first, questions later. In a way, they kind of captured they hark back to that kind of offbeat, unnerving kind of dystopian energy that Split Enz used to have. That, you know, you think back to some of that kind of deliberately vaudeville, whenever you look at it, Split Enz, you kind of feel there's something not quite right about this. There's something a bit unnerving. There's something a bit kind of... And the Mint Chicks kind of captured that same kind of energy. Just being deliberately obtuse and sort of atonal.
That'd be a good one to explore in the classics, actually, because... I don't know, like, I know Split Enz songs, but I don't know whether I've ever listened to a full Split Enz album to sort of capture a period. I've only ever listened to a greatest hit sort of style mix of their songs.
I think they date furiously. Mm. I really do.
Well, if you're worried about bands that are going to date furiously, you're not going to be happy with my classic this week then. Anyway, keep going.
Is it fucking right on 1987 or whatever that fucking thing is. Because literally dates. There's a, again, on the spin-off, there was a good interview with Cody Nielsen about the sort of the dysfunction and the breakup of the Mint Chicks. But this was back when they were at their peak. And of course, I remember it was a line from a Len Deighton spy novel talking about one of the characters was that their eyes sort of burnt with the fury that you see in a light bulb when it's just about to go ping. They always burn a little bit brighter just before they go ping. And this band was that was the point at which that this album came out. So I respect the energy and I respect the inventiveness of this, but I think Fuck the Golden Youth is actually a better album. They're certainly a more approachable and listenable album. There's a little bit too much art for art's sake on this, on Crazy No Dumb Yes, Crazy Yes Dumb No.
So the first half of the album, it's not punk. It's what would you call it?
It's punk. Yeah, okay. Cool. It's discordant. Yeah, it's sort of art. It's art punk. You know, I'd throw it in with, you know, there's a lot of other stuff that's like that, particularly around this time. Because remember, this is like 2000.
So occasionally when I'm listening to these albums, I click on the artist rather than the album, and then I press play. And because I have the boys' daycare playlist on shuffle all the time, it shuffles, but it shuffles through their whole catalog, not just through the album. And so, you know, you get these. You get one song and then something that sounds completely different, even though it's from the same band, because it's like 20 years apart. And so I put this album...
Except when it's ACD.
Except when it's ACD. I put this album on and it was on shuffle, but for the album, but I had that same experience because it went from like track 2 to track 10 and it just sound completely fucking different. So is that just the brothers' songwriting? Like one... getting six songs and one getting the rest, or what's that about?
Well, also there were other creatives in the group as well. So I think there was a lot of, I'd certainly say the first album was a lot more coherent in terms of the sound and the idea.
I'm going to go back and listen to the first album then, because I quite like this album, even though as you have said many, many times, I do not get punk and I do not understand it. And
Well, it's not pure punk. It's much more art punk. It's much noise punk. It's art first, and it happens to involve punk concepts, which is a distorted guitar played loudly and quickly and thrashing around. But it's but that's all punk is. I mean, there's nothing to get.
Well, there must be something, because I don't seem to get it. But anyway,
Well, you're now a Cosmic Psychos fan, so you understand, Punk.
I quite like the riff in the that was under your voice in that After Dark, which everyone should go and listen to. The After Dark that the doc get.
Yeah, with Bezo's voice went last week, so we couldn't record it After Dark, so we weren't going to do an ep. And then I thought about it for a while. I thought and then I saw Cahill Tex, and I thought, who else has fucked their legacy this week? And then I thought, I might just do some quick passes.
It is a good idea to go back and at the end of the year and give that award out, though.
I mean, I would not have picked any of those albums for a week, because my tendency is I want to hear new stuff. I mean, I kind of know what the new a Monster Magnet album is going to sound like. I know what a Judas Priest album is going to sound like.
Well, I was the same as you. I had that Arctic Monkeys album in my shortlist because I was like, I'm getting lots of people saying that it's a good album in my feed. You know, and Ace McWicked saying that it was crap doesn't exactly turn me off, because him and I have very different tastes.
No, but I knew that if it was going to be shitty lounge music, that I knew exactly what it was going to sound like, because I'd heard some of that Last Shadow Puppet shit.
Sounded,
and that's exactly what I thought it was going to sound like, and it was fucking
pissed. The bit that you played, which I assume is the best of the album, sounded like bad Dave Graney. You know, that sort of talky, but without the, you know, Dave Graney's got a sort of theatricality to it that fits his.
Well, Alex Taylor used to. That's the thing that he used to write such brilliant lyrics, and we talked about this when we did whatever people say, and that's what I'm not, as a classic album. Is that he's writing fucking poetry about drunk cunts punching on in Sheffield town centre after a big night on the lash. He's finding a way to capture that mundane, hopeless, you know, boozy youth lifestyle in a way that, you know, it was fucking poetry. And now he's just a rich, smug rock star. He's got nothing to say that's worth hearing.
That's really sad, because that was the one point of difference they had
over any of the bands of their, you know, like Franz Ferdinand. And I mean, Franz Ferdinand could write a lyric too. They were very art rock as well.
But it's, that's the saddest part, is that I love that first album as much for its lyrics as well, for its sound. Well,
probably the difference is that Dave Graney has never been a superstar. He's never had the money to fall into excess. You know, he's always had to be a working artist. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's.
But that's fun. It's 20 minutes out of your life, folks. You
yeah, go and it's good
to
fun.
It if you haven't listened to it already.
All right. Before we get on to next week's new albums, I've been. My eldest has an iPad, and it's one of the old iPads. And.
Children these days are completely.
They are, probably. Well.
Yeah, but that was said about
yeah,
us.
Yeah, and it was probably said about the cavemen. We
didn't die of polio. You know, we had all the advantages.
We didn't have rocks like you had rocks when you were a kid. But anyway, I've been trying not to just let him.
Luxury. We had to live in a lick.
I've been trying to get him some create, because he likes learning and he likes being creative. So I was like, oh, I wonder if there's like an NPC app, you know, something that's like, you know, beats for 5 year olds or beats for 6 year olds.
Melbourne Performance Centre, who prepare Audis for
racing. So I had a bit of a dig around the Googles, and I found this app called Incredibox, which is basically like a, you know, it's like a layered samples thing. You know, it's got drums and vocals and sort of bleeps and blops. And anyway, I show him how to use it, and within a week, he's pretty much making songs that would be the fourth or fifth best track on a Daft Punk album. I'm quite impressed.
Oh, you've turned on Daft Punk.
I have fucking turned on Daft Punk. I have to say, if you go,
well, they embarrassed you in public, and that is when a band turns when you turn on a band. If they embarrass you in public.
If you've got a kid who's got an iPad that's interested in music and you've got $5, buy this one. It is, like, I have to say, I've had as much fun on it as Curtis, and we've been sitting around playing it together. It's called Incredibox, and it's just, it's so well designed that you can do some pretty cool stuff with it if you're into that electronic music. Like, I guess it's not that different from what you guys were playing around with, but that probably the ease of use is.
Oh, yeah. Because you had, you effectively had, Adam will probably correct me on this, but there's something like 64 slots per. It was almost like you were laying it out in a sort of a digital pianola. You had like four, there were four channel sound, and it would just sort of give you 64 slots on each sort of page, and then it would just put on each. I can't remember what they were called, but they were. And you would just sort of slot the music, the samples you wanted to use. It was like a sequencer, effectively, a four channel sequencer. Well, and then it would play.
This gives you 8 tracks, and it's like, I think you get 6 drums, sort of 6 drum sort of sounding tracks, 6 sort of vocals. So, you know, you've got people singing little audio loops, and then you have like bleeps and bloops, and I don't know. It's. I'll make a track and send it to you to give you an idea of what it's like. But, you know, there's whistling, it's all sorts of stuff. But
make a track and make it the
outro. Well, actually, what I'll do is I'll get Curtis to make a track and I'll make that the outro. But even he's got down.
Oh, great. This is actually worse than when people show you their kids. They're like, isn't it great? I'm like, yeah, it's great.
Right? But he loaded it up the other day and he'd gotten the simple concept of, you know, lay down a single vocal or, you know, sort of like an intro and give it a few bars before you drop the bass. You know, you drop the you know, either a bass guitar or that big thumping beat. And I was like, that's fucking impressive that you picked that up, because
does he just stand over the corner going, DJ Khaled?
No, I'll teach him those skills are valuable. shall we say. Anyway, let's get on to your albums before I say something completely inappropriate.
DJ Khaled needs to brush up his skills that he does not have.
Are we still in New Zealand Music Month? Are you going for more Kiwi bands?
If we are doing new music, I will do. I'll go again. Don't feel obliged to. I'm going to go again. Going to give you an album from not quite a legacy act, because they were kind of a. So there was this band in the, I suppose the noughts you'd say, alternative metal Kiwi band called Blind Spot, and they were quite popular and got played on the radio and were not quite overseas popular, not quite She-Head popular, if you like, not a sound not terribly far away, I think you'd say, but they split up, and then members of that band went on to form a band called I Am Giant, and this was less metal, a little bit more mainstream rock, radio kind of music. And they have put out, they've only, because their members are kind of distributed across the world, like some are in the UK, some are here, some are elsewhere. I don't record that often. And they've put out an album which they claim is going to be their last album because it's too fucking hard to get them all in the same room. This is a little bit like the Datsuns problem is that when they get together and record an album, it's usually fucking awesome, but they don't get to do that very often because they all live on, you know, distant corners of the world. So I Am Giant have a new album out, which is likely to be their last album. It is called Insert Name of Album Here. I did know, but I
thought, oh no, I thought that would make an excellent album title.
That's very meta. I think that's probably an album title I used in that series I wrote. I'm pretty sure I had. There was the first album was called self-titled debut album. Life in Captivity is the name of the album from I Am Giant. It may be a bit middle of the road, or it may be really good. I don't know. I've never been that much of a I Am Giant freakout type because I don't listen to that much commercial rock radio. But I'll be interested to see where they are because they are kind of a low, not a top tier legacy act, but they're certainly an example of where New Zealand, mainstream New Zealand rock has been for the past sort of 10, 15 years. So it's interesting to see where they got to and where that field got to. And for a band at the other end of the journey, there is a band who have just dropped their new album, and they are called Skinny Hobos, and they are getting quite a lot of vibe around the parts of New Zealand. They've dropped their new album. I think it's self-titled. It's literally a self-titled debut album. And I suspect it's going to be quite good. So, again, it's a little bit, white men in a rock band kind of thing. Well, some of them are brown men. But let's face it, going away from that model got us October and Evan Sparrow, that didn't do us very good.
October.
Let's stick to what works.
So, I've been thinking a little bit about pop and how I like bands. Well, I quite like sort of that 80s influenced synth in modern music, like LaRue. I quite like. You're not going to like where this is going. And so I was trying to think about what was the music that I liked in period that sort of it makes me like the modern takes on those music. So one of the boys keep asking for new songs, and I keep sort of throwing all different stuff in the daycare playlist, and I put Breakaway by Big Pig in there this morning, which sort of really took me back to that late 80s sort of mindset. But
Big Pig were almost, you'd almost call them an art.
Yeah, it was.
Because they were all about that. They were part of a proto-industrial band. They were trying to make a statement and do an installation rather than necessarily make a pretty pop song.
Yeah, and even in their film clip, it was like the whole film clip was like a statement. But
Yeah, it was like an industrial abattoir. A lot of the kind of a lot of clanging and banging and stuff, which was an 80s. I mean, fucking River Runs Dry by your boys, Hunters and Collectors, had that same kind of very metallic clanging.
Especially, yeah, on the album version, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that was actually so I think all of those songs, well the album I'm going to pick had a single off that was on this album, Big Pig, and I think the river Runs Dry was on that album as well. But the band that I came back to, which I think sort of influenced the way that I really enjoyed Imperiod, haven't listened to for 25 years, have no idea whether it's any good or not, is Roxette. And I'm going to go with 1998's Look Sharp, because I love Roxette Imperiod.
1988.
So did I say 1998?
Look Sharp. You said 1998. I was thinking,
No. 1988's Look Sharp. I think the single, I think it was 1989's Smash Hits. I might look that.
Yeah, that would be it, because their first single was She's Got the Look.
She's got the look.
You know, She's Got the Look. She's got the look. They wrote really good pop songs. Yeah. They were an example of a band that wrote exceptionally good pop songs. They were almost like a late 80s ABBA.
Yeah. It was that 89 had that neon sort of font, just an 89 on the front of it.
Yep.
Was it on there? No, it wasn't.
Well, they blew up because one of their songs was in the Pretty Woman
song. Okay.
I think it was one of the songs off this album. Was it? It must have been Love.
Yes. Yep. Okay, yep.
Now. Yeah, I think that got in the Pretty Woman soundtrack, and that was what blew it all up. But She's Got the Look was certainly the first big song that they did. I think there were quite a few singles off
that.
But I'm also not sure where the second album
was. This is where Roxette is not actually on that album, but anyway. Big Pig, Breakaway, Cheap Trick, The Flame, Yaz and the Plastic Population, The Only Way Is Up.
See, Cheap Trick, I know this. I think I had this compilation. The thing is that Cheap Trick, The Flame, gave me a completely incorrect impression of what kind of band Cheap Trick were, because I thought, they just played ballads. Turns out they were like a fucking sleazy rock and roll band. You know, they were like a fucking. They're kind of held up as a as an inspiration to a lot of those sort of garage punk bands. I mean, the Datsuns, when I went to see the Datsuns play in the Metro in Sydney about 15 years ago, they opened with a Cheap Trick song. And it's like, that was what they did. But when I was, what are we talking, 11? When they did The Flame, I was like, oh, this is what this band does. Just the same, like the Beach Boys did Kokomo, which is this ridiculous kind of.
And
the idea that, you know, all that fucking, you know, what the Beach Boys really did was early rock and roll in a certain context.
That really.
It's funny how your perceptions kind of get set.
This is a very interesting album, the Smash Hits 88, because there's stuff that I definitely look down on, like Bros, the Kylie Minogue song, Billy Ocean.
But they were really, if you look back at them, they were really well done pop songs.
Well, there's other pop songs that I quite think of fondly. Terence Trent D'Arby, Choir Boys, Big Pig song, Cheap Trick song. I actually like The Only Way Is Up. It's like like a desperately positive song. It's sort of like almost depressingly positive. Fairground Attraction, Perfects.
That jazz song is that jazz song is almost like a partner to Things Could Only Get Better by Dream, which of course featured Professor Brian Cox on keyboards.
So anyway, we'll go Roxette because.
I'm comfortable with that because every one of those songs that you've described, I not only know the song, but I can
picture
the
film. Yes, that's right.
That was the time. That was my peak watching Rage period. Like Fairground Attraction, Perfect. I fucking hated that song to bits, but I can tell you, I know exactly what it was like. I know. I can tell you every fucking scene.
So Look Sharp had The Look, Dress for Success,
Dress for
Dangerous.
Going to Get Undressed for Some Sex, which was the schoolyard.
Listen to Your Heart, and I Could Never Give You Up.
Take a listen. Should we just do this podcast as karaoke next week?
Maybe.
We'll just sing it.
I can see Adam pounding.
Because I know every word of this fucking album because it's just seeped into my head. I can see
Adam demanding to be on a third wheel on this podcast next week.
He'll just sing us.
That's true. He's probably played a few of these songs, but...
No, I don't think so. I don't think we had a terrible amount of...
I'm interested to see whether this is the sort of... this is what I think is influencing the LaRues of the world. Like, this is the, you know, the source material for the nostalgia that I find in some of the sort of rock pop acts that are kicking around, that are mining that 80s nostalgia.
Did you know that Roxette put out an album in 2016?
Yeah, I did, actually.
Fucking hell.
That's...
what the hell would they sound like? I don't want to know. In 2012? 2011? Fucking hell. Maybe this is our legacy.
I was going to say, if they had one and you ever miss an episode, because you never miss an episode because you're much better at it than I am, you know, Roxette would be an excellent legacy act for me to hit.
I don't want to be replaced. But the thing is that Roxette released the greatest hits in 1995, which is a sure sign they thought, fuck it, we're done. And that was after they'd done a rarities release in 95. Crash Boom Bang, that was their 94 album. That wasn't that successful. Although I do remember the single in it, Crash Boom Bang. Tourism was 92, which was the one that had...
yeah, I think...
that's a live album. Joyride was the 91 album. Of course, Joyride was the single. That was probably my favourite Roxette song, I think, Joyride.
Yeah, Joyride's the last one I remember. I think it had Joyride and the Big L was the two singles, maybe.
I mean, they did all right for writing in not their language. I mean, there's been a long tradition of Swedish people writing English language pop songs and being massively successful.
Well, I can
Max Martin, who writes all the fucking Taylor
stuff. I can remember being so 88, I would have been 11. I can remember being absolutely shocked when I first heard them do an interview, and I was like, but they sound nothing like this when they sing. They sing in really easily understood English.
Well, that's the thing. They're just copying noises. I mean, I was listening to a Turbo Negro live album a week or so ago that I hadn't heard before. It was like from the late 90s, and all their songs are in English. And all their stage banter is in Norwegian. Right. It's like listening to a fucking rally commentary inside a car. And it's like, it's
I was listening to...
don't say motherfucker, motherfucker.
I was listening to Schumacher talk about the Princess Bride and the fact that Andre the Giant...
Schumacher!
Had,
Ralph or Mike?
Had David. Had, the director gave him all his dialogue on a Walkman, and he basically just learnt it phonetically. Didn't understand a word. You know, he knew that when this person said this, you would say that. And that's why it's got that sort of strange, stilted feel to it, because he's basically just copying the sounds. He has absolutely no context of what he's saying.
How's a pop album with 18 tracks on
it? Yeah.
Which is what Joyride was. It went for an hour 11. I don't believe that was the full version. I don't believe that was what the version that the market actually heard.
Well, I scrolled through all the way back because it had 2009 version, and that makes me nervous.
But I think they've only got the re-releases. But it looks like there's a couple of demos on the end. But albums were long back then. They wanted to get their values worth for... that was a period in which, you know, they wanted to get their values worth for the CD because it was expensive to press CDs.
I had a...
She's armed and she's extremely dangerous. Shit, Jesus. Fuck. This is very creepy. We are going to lose all our audience under the age of 30 because they're going to be thinking, what the fuck is wrong with you,
guys? Smash It's 90 was quite interesting. Faith...
But this is exactly what, because music in those days, it was a fucking monoculture. We got our music through music television. We got it through Rage. We maybe got it through commercial radio, which was playing the same shit.
So how many albums would you expect to get The Angels, Dogs Are Talking, Faith No More, Epic, and also Milli Vanilli, Blame It on the Rain, and Craig McLaughlin and Check 1-2 Smona? Who likes those songs together? Oh my God.
The people of Australia. Who
1990 was really the, like, when things were starting to change in popular music and smash hits really hadn't worked it out. I
feel like, I mean, the easy analogy is that grunge was about to come and wash it all into the sea, but that's not really what happened, because if you listened, there was still a lot of shit. There's always been shit in the charts, but there was still a lot of shit in the charts in 91, 92.
I had a relative that gave me a smash hits album one year for Christmas, and I just fucking played it until the tape wore out. And so she was like, well, you know, I think she'd struggle to yeah, you enjoyed this forever, now you will get smash hits, tapes or CDs. So every year until I think 1994, I got the smash hits album for that year.
What did that have? A fucking Melody MC, Dum Da Dum or something on it?
Yeah. It.
I think I have the last smash hit style compilation I have is probably from about 93. Because we got Triple J in 94, and that was, as I've always said, fucking it was ground zero. That the clock was reset. It was like, oh, there's all this other music. I'm not just obliged to listen to the fucking Take 40 countdown on commercial radio, waiting for the one song I like in the top 20 to come on.
Well, it's interesting because 90 had that first inkling that grunge was coming, and then 91 was like a pushback on it. It's almost all pop, a little bit of hip hop, De La Soul, Jimmy Barnes, but at that stage he was pretty pop. But you know,
he was always popular.
Because yeah, he was. But you've got like Sky Hooks. You've got some throwback Australian rock: Hoodagurus, Braithwaite, Sky Hooks.
Well, in those days, the Hoodagurus weren't throwback; they were state of the art.
Miss Free Love '69.
Yep, that was
Jukebox in Siberia.
That was all Kinky, which is the '91 album. The Gurus back catalogue is now on, or it should be now on
Spotify. Oh, on Spotify. We should do a Gurus classic then.
We will do a Gurus. Once we get the other side of, we get the other side of New Zealand music.
My favourite cringeworthy 90s song warrants Cherry Pie.
Well, actually, the cool thing about the Gurus is they've got all of the cool stuff from their Bite the Bullet thing, which is one of my favorite Gurus albums, which isn't really an album, was a three album thing called Bite the Bullet. And it had a really good live album, and it had a whole bunch of rarities and fucking odd bits and pieces. And it also had a CD that was entirely them live at the Wireless on Triple J. Yep. And that's actually some of the best shit. Is them playing live? Yeah,
tell you what, the 92 smash hits really went into the. There was some. Once grunge took hold, there was some real. What would you call it? Sort of like trick pop, you know, like pop, like Right Said Fred, I'm Too Sexy, Criss Cross's Jump.
It's just pop music. That's what pop music was.
There's some good stuff here too, though. The KLF, Justified and The Ancient. I love that song.
Yeah, that was a fantastic album act. And it was kind of disappointing that their comeback was really just an art installation in a museum rather than being actual new
and,
music.
And Big Audio, Dynamite's The Globe, which is another one that's been one that's been added to the daycare playlist that's had immediate traction. That and Rush. I've had requests for that because they're like, we jump in the car and I'm like, oh, what would you like to listen to this morning? And normally it's the Batman song, but you know, quite often we get something different, but it's been Rush quite a bit this week. Anyway, there's a troll back through, my pop career, but I'm very interested to see whether, the rest of that Roxette album holds up or whether it's just absolute crap filler.
whether it's turd and crap and it's just those singles.
Yeah, because
hold up. And whether Joyride was a better album, I'm not sure if I'll have time to dig into that.
We'll see. I think I might prioritize going.
And yet again, I can rely on you to balance out the huge amount of fucking penis extension cock rock that I pick on the show, with something that's got something in it that's not that.
So. I think I might go listen to the older Mint Chicks album before I go back and listen to older Roxette, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, you should probably do that. But that was the album that made me think of kind of two playing an earlier era Regurgitator without the hip-hop and scratching elements. It was really that one that made me think, shit, this is the same kind of nervous inventiveness, if you like.
All right, Doc. It's been good to chat to you.
I think that's us.
Yeah,
it's been good to have you to have a voice. It's been good to not be talking to myself.
If you were a child of the 90s and you did listen to the Smash Hits, go back and look at the track listings and tell me which Smash Hits album you think is the best. Because I'd be fascinated to know.
You have a Smash Hits off. Unfortunately, the Smash Hits aren't on. Oh, you know what we should do? We should do a version for kids who are a bit later and say, which Triple J Hottest
100. Yeah, that's a good one too.
I've noticed in New Zealand, they didn't get Triple J, but they got the compilation CDs. And that was how, that was almost like their, for a lot of kids, I know. Like,
even when we came to uni, that's an interesting thing because those became a real, other than Live Throwing Copper, which that and 10 of the two classic albums, I refuse to fucking do on this podcast because I'm just going to destroy.
You know, if I didn't hate Live so much, I would pick it just for the ones.
I don't.
Just for the hashtag.
I don't know whether my brain could actually process that album critically or whether it would just go back into this.
It would just be an unpleasant experience.
Bad fucking share house parties where I'm like, can we please listen to something fucking else? Anything. Anything.
Well, that we talked about that with that fucking Cake album, because I had that same kind of reaction because, you know, it reminded me of being trapped in this fucking horrible college with surrounded by fucking entitled.
But isn't it weird? The thing I find, and maybe it's just too depressing, but no one ever played Nevermind like that. 10, absolutely. Live Throwing Copper, absolutely. Like, and I'm not just talking about the houses that I lived in. Like, Live was the album that you'd go to a house party and the fucking bogan that owned four albums and one of them would be Live Throwing Copper and the other one would be 10 Pearl Jam.
It's funny. I think the Nirvana fan base was slightly different from the Pearl Jam fan base. The Pearl Jam fan base was probably the probably just the sort of fan base that would have been into cock rock in the 80s.
Anyway, all right, Doc. I will catch you on the flip side, but hit us up on the socials if you want to have an opinion.
Well, if you have it, you're allowed to have an opinion whether you're on the socials or not, but if you want to express the opinion to us and have us acknowledge that your opinion exists, then you'll probably need to tell us about it.
Very good.
You can find us at The Balls Podcast. I'm at Dr. Yobo. He's at Bezo. And we will talk at you next week. I was all right.
I was really worried. I was like, because I've actually like that pop album really made me. Because I was like, I'm quite enjoying this, and I'm like, look, I don't mind some pop. Like, because I come off really sort of anti-pop in some of my, you know, rantings.
Not as me. I just refuse to accept that it's not listenable at all. I mean, if like, you listen back to that episode, at no point did I ever say that October was an album that you should listen to, because you shouldn't.
It's no.
It's awful. I'd never want to hear that album again. But
wow.
I somehow have managed to get away with it without actually trashing the nice lady and her artistic efforts.
You're starting to get more dance and hip hop in 93. Unlimited.
Yeah.
House of Pain. The Shaman. I love that song.
Yes. The fucking Shaman. Or what a carry on. But that's also that Manchester House scene sort of bleeding into the pop charts, which we didn't really get. I mean, if they'd done like a Smash Hits Great Britain, it would have looked very different.
Yeah. But then you had
some of the same crossover, but
you had Ace of Base, Culture Beat.
Ace of Base
Beat,
were fucking everywhere.
Peter so Andre
must be there somewhere.
No. Tony Perrin. Oh, I play that for the boys.
Tony Perrin was a fucking soap opera. A soapy.
Yeah.
She was in like East Street or some shit like that.
Jeremy Jordan. Who the fuck's that?
No idea.
Deep Forest. I quite like that song. Lenny Kravitz. That was a good album, that Lenny Kravitz album. Things of Stone at Wood.
His second album in 93. That would have been the one. Are You Gonna Go My Way?
Which, Things of Stone at Wood, I can only ever see the Late Show parody. Late Show
parody. It's funny how Kravitz, a lot of, like, there's black American guys like Bomani Jones view Lenny Kravitz the same way that a lot of dudes view Wolfmother, in that it's as a lame pastiche who they hate because they're such a pastiche of what they should be. And it's funny, I never really saw Kravitz as that growing up, but then again, I hadn't known Zeppelin and the Prince and the people he was supposedly lifting from.
Yeah, see, I think 93 was the last one that I listened to, and then 94 I started.
Finding your own shit.
Yeah. Wow, Smash is 94. You're gonna be fucking kidding me.
At some point, because it was, now that's what I call music.
Because 94 was like R. Kelly, Take That, M. People.
How has R. Kelly been around that long? He must be 90 and he's still pissing on teenage girls.
East 17.
How could East 17 be that late? I thought they were done by like 91.
It's probably like, you know, the best single. Two Unlimited. Shoop is 94.
In my head, I had that as like 91. But that makes more sense because I remember...
See, like, I don't know.
I remember
half
going
the fucking...
to like a year 11 camp. I think we were being trained as the peer support leaders for the younger kids.
See, and then you're starting to get like, you've got Chili Peppers, Suede and Oasis. You know, so you're starting to get a bit of that in.
Yeah, but Chili Peppers had already been in because 91 was a lot earlier.
Mm.
It's just but a matter yeah, of like... you could get the rights to. I mean, I wouldn't...
Mm.
I would not really take it as a... I mean, even the Triple J Hot 100 albums were only reflective of what they could get the rights to. There were much bigger
albums.
Yeah,
that's right. It wasn't 1 to 20, was it?
It was always a selection. It was sort of most of 1 to 30 and a selection of the other things, but it depended on what they could get the rights to. I mean, I think as far as I remember, the Cranberries Zombie was huge one year, but it wasn't on the album because they didn't get the rights to it. Maybe I'm thinking of something else like that. It might have been garbage. But it's funny how those albums became, like, as I said, in New Zealand, those albums were kind of revered the way that the actual Triple J itself was revered in Australia, in that it opened up, it was a currency of its own in terms of explaining to people what, you know, what alternative music was. Because, of course, in New Zealand, there wasn't much indie music getting played.
See, like, from 87, right, the 87 smash hits to like, 91 is such a fucking difference. 87 was Mel and Kim, Samantha Fox, Mental as Anything, Kylie Minogue, The Angels, Bananarama, Bangles, Noiseworks, Pseudo Echo, Slice of Heaven, Wawani, Angry Anderson.
See, a lot of those could have been on the 91 smash hits because they all had hits in 91.
Mm.
So I wouldn't hold this as any kind of documented record. I think it was just, you know,
no,
who they had on the catalogue that they wanted to bump at the time.
Well, it's also whoever, so who did it? So CBS was Liberation at CBS, which is like, you know, there's obviously some executive that's fucking tasked with doing this. So it's pretty much what they're the tastemaker, aren't they? What they think is the taste. Fuck, it'd be really interesting to talk to someone that actually got to pick the songs on
They can't remember anything about that. This is like LeBron James in game two. He's been concussed for the last week. He can't remember a fucking thing that happened. It's like your mate who you went in to meet when you were asking for some CDs for the alley, and he said, "Mate, I'm taking you out to the fucking
he can't
the piss all day. We gone to the strippers and snorted cocaine off some girl's ass, and now I can give you these stack of CDs." And you're like, "Stack of CDs, he's fucking awesome."
I do know someone that's quite still in quite high up in the music industry. I should find out whether he can tell me any stories about these compilations.
Well,
but
still do them, don't they? They're still now local music. I think
they do them. Like you see them with Woolworths fucking, petrol stations for fuck's sake. But I don't think they have the cultural cachet they used to.
Absolutely.
Spotify has absolutely killed them, but
Spotify, just everything.
It was interesting. Catch posted on Facebook this week that his own song came up on his release radar, and he was like, "Fuck, that's a bit weird." It's because obviously all the stuff that you're into is influencing the sort of music that you write, so you would hope that your song comes up in your release radar.
It's kind of telling on yourself. It's like, shit, am I influence is that obvious? But I mean, but of course, that's not how release radar works. It just works on
what songs
other people have added to playlists along with that song, and that sort of has like a series of a million Venn diagrams of songs. Like, here's the overlap of this song and this artist, so maybe the sum of all those Venn diagrams means that if you've been listening to Wolf Mother, maybe you'd like to be listening to Monster Magnet or something.
Yeah, I'm a bit scared to pick that Resin Dogs album, but anyway. All right, I'll talk to you later.
You need to do it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to, but yeah, out of loyalty,
you need to do it.
Yeah. All right, Doc, I'll catch you later.
Cheers.